for the evening talks that what I've done before in retreats is to have the opportunity for people to ask questions on pieces of paper. And that's very useful because sometimes there's questions which arise during the meditation and which I don't address during the formal talks in the morning. And it gives an opportunity for the meditators to define the evening talk. I would ask so because usually the number of questions seems to increase every day of retreat. So if you can just put one question in per person every a day, no more than one question a day, because that gives an opportunity for all the questions to be properly addressed. And if you can, try and keep them just on meditation, on Buddhism, rather than other things. The first question, why do I have more aches and pains than usual during the retreat? Sometimes it can be because of tension, expectation. You make the body tight. When the body, you make the body tight, then you get more aches and pains. That's why it is very important to relax the body and give the body some ease during this meditation retreat. No need to sit so long if it's aching and having pains. Remember that when you were young, you learned how to ride a bicycle. But when you were very tense and tight and held those handlebars like very firmly, you'd always fall off. But when you relax, you find you could balance very easily, very naturally. The same way with the body, that so often that we like riding a bike, we try too hard, and we keep on falling off. But when you relax, you find you can meditate very well and very effectively. And you don't get so many aches and pains. Remember, if you do have a stiff body, then do lots of walking meditation. And not just slow walking, sometimes do fast walking. Walking backwards and forwards, just to get all of the blockages in the body moving again. So that's one of the things you can do if you have some aches and pains, but it's probably just because of a bit of tension, expectation about what's happening during the retreat. I find it easier to concentrate on reciting Amitabha, similar to Buddha. Would I reach jhana using this method? Now you can't use reach jhana just by continuing with a mantra. You have to let go of the mantra. And the mantra, any old mantra, whatever it is, whether it's Shut Up or Amitabha or Buddha, whatever the mantra is, it's only the beginning of the practice. And eventually the whole idea of a mantra is to bring you into the present moment. So, you know, when you're saying a mantra to yourself or word over and over and over and over again, you can't really sort of go thinking about the past and the future. And it's just one step from silence. Instead of having many thoughts in your mind, you've only got one thought in the mind, the mantra. So you start with the mantra, it gives you silence, it gives you present moment awareness and a certain degree of silence, but not enough silence. Then you have to let go of the mantra. And just have a bit of silence there. And then you have to take up the meditation object. Something like the breath and or loving kindness. To be able to get that unity of perception and that brightness and beauty of perception, which would eventually lead to jhanas. So it's okay to do these things at the beginning, but don't do them all the while. Once the job has been done, then go on to the deeper stages. Can we please do some chanting before the sitting session in the morning? Well, what time is the sitting session in the morning? It's 6 o'clock. You want to do some chanting at 6 o'clock? Sometimes that one of the problems with chanting that it does disturb the practice in the sense that some people get up very early and be meditating, and when it gets to 6 o'clock and someone rings the bell, they're really sort of flying high and very deep in their meditation, and to be interrupted to do some chanting can be quite a tragic waste of an opportunity. If we were going to do some chanting, it should be at the beginning of a session rather than the middle or the end of it. So, if anyone's got any suggestions, what's a suitable time for chanting? But I wouldn't like to like to do it at 6 o'clock because that's a bit too much in the middle of things.
Yeah.
4:30 in the morning. Even so, I'm not quite sure what happened this morning, that sometimes people even get up earlier than that, and they like to chant, but they like to sit quietly earlier. I think that chanting is sometimes good for devotion, but I'm just wondering what is a good time for chanting. Maybe even before the evening talk.
Just before break up for lunch.
Yeah, sometimes people are already outside there. Maybe you can do it sort of at 7:15, before the evening talk. Then it doesn't sort of interrupt things. Okay, so it's 7:15. When practicing present moment awareness, can we concentrate on an object other than the breath, such as bodily sensations? Indeed, the present moment awareness, sometimes people aren't really quite sure what present moment awareness means. It means anything, any object whatsoever, which is there in the present moment, you can take that as your object of awareness. You don't need to stay on one particular object, because the present moment is always changing, and many different objects are coming into the present moment. The point being here is that to make sure that your awareness is free from the past and the future. So present moment awareness is defined not so much what it consists of, but what's absent. And learning how to define something by what's absent is a very powerful meditation technique. We're not so much aware of what's there, but we're aware of what's missing. If any of you ever try the meditation on emptiness, as the Buddha described it, he always said to notice what the mind is empty of, what you're free from. And that will give rise to a lot of happiness, a lot of bliss, and eventually it's a good path into the jhanas. So just like when you come here, you know, you're free from your husband, you're free from your wife, you're free from your children, you're free from the kitchen, you're free from the work, I'm free from my monastery, you're free from the telephone. And when you actually perceive and remember all the things you're free from, it gives you a sense of happiness. You're actually not taking for granted the situation where you're in. You're realizing so many things you're free from. And when you get to the present moment awareness, you notice you're free from the past and the future. In silence, you're free from thoughts. In the breath, you are free from diversity. You just have unity. When you go from the breath into the nimittas, there you're free from the five senses. When you go from the nimittas into the jhanas, there you're free from the from the restlessness of the mind. Each one of these different stages of freedom is letting go of something and realizing that you've let go of something, noticing what you're free of. So in present moment awareness, we realize we're aware, awake to the fact we've let go of the past and the future. So it can be a sound which you're listening to. It can be a feeling in the body. It can be the breath. It can be a mantra. It does not matter, as long as it's something which is happening now. And you're not at all concerned with yesterday or tomorrow. You're not concerned with 5 minutes ago or 5 minutes in the future. That's what present moment awareness is. Is that clear, or does anyone want to make any more of that? Okay. Could you please explain the basic steps for meditation? Okay, so I was explaining this morning. The first step for meditation is getting the body comfortable. Reasonably comfortable. Don't try and get it absolutely comfortable, because you'll never be able to make it absolutely comfortable. It's the nature of the body to be irritating. You make it reasonably comfortable, and then you leave it alone and allow it to disappear. That's the first step, preliminary step. The next step is to present moment awareness. So no past and no future. The next thing you let go of, the next stage of calming down, is no thinking, silence. The next stage from silence is to be aware of the breath. I rushed these stages this morning when I got to the breath. With the breath, there's several stages of breath to be observed. First of all, it's just the ordinary breath. But as you increase your awareness, as the mind settles down onto the breath, instead of just the breath going in and going out, you get the full awareness of the breath. And by the full awareness of the breath, I mean from the very beginning of an in-breath, right to the end of an in-breath, you have continuous attention. So you don't even miss a part of the sensation of breathing. And even when the in-breath finishes and before the out-breath begins, you're even mindful of that pause where there's no breathing going on at all. And when the out-breath begins, you're there watching, right to the end of the out-breath. And then so on for each in-breath and out-breath. It's called full awareness of the breath. And from that full awareness of the breath, you will find that it will turn into a very beautiful breath. And not really perceiving whether it's in or out, but just perceiving breath, that's all. A much more singular oneness of perception. Oneness in time rather than oneness in space. And as you develop that one-pointedness, that one-peakedness of mind, then that's when the meditation starts to get very happy. And from that the breath disappears and you're left with the happiness which has to appear as a beautiful image in the mind. Those deeper stages of meditation I'm going to repeat tomorrow morning, make that the subject of the talk, is the higher stages of this meditation. But for the time being, just to be in the present moment, to be silent, or even just to be one-pointed on the breath, that's enough for the time being. Don't rush too fast. Those stages are natural, universal stages of letting go. This is just what happens when the mind starts to slow down and stop. It's the same from fourth gear you go to third gear, from third gear to second, from second to first gear. And then you come to a stop and you can put it in park. And you have to go through those gears. And if you try to jump gears, then you can sort of ruin your car. So these are natural stages of the mind slowing down, which you can recognize. Another talk later on, I'm going to explain the Anapanasati Sutta, I hope, if I get around to it, which shows how the Buddha described these very same stages, but just in a different language. So that's another talk coming up later. To combine this method of meditation with classical breath meditation taught by the Buddha 25 centuries ago. This is what happens with meditation. It's all just letting go. Letting go stage by stage. Outer skin of the onion, inner skins, until everything's gone. Is that okay? Is loving kindness conditioned or unconditioned? We're taught to radiate loving kindness just to ourselves, then to a teacher, an Arya, a close friend, a neutral person, an enemy. The understanding here is this process is tainted with a more or lesser degree of like, dislike, or emotional attachment, non-attachment. Like in the case of mother having met her for her child. This bond most time has emotional attachment involved. Even the metta we have for ourselves could well be filled with ego of the self or some form of delusion. How is one able to truly practice metta in meditation in our daily living? Thank you for your clarification. Is loving kindness conditioned or unconditioned? Loving kindness is, like everything else you can put a name to, is conditioned. It's a way of leading the mind out of conditioning, because loving kindness meditation, you start with something which is very beautiful, which is emotional, and which is very close to affection. And if you're not very careful with loving kindness, it can even lead into lust. That's why it's a danger there. When Ajahn Chah took the monks to England for the first time, he gave them a warning. He told them, he said, please be careful not to do too much loving kindness, otherwise you'll end up having babies. How's that sense, yeah? And there is a danger there for loving kindness. The romantic attachment leads to lust. So, but if a person does loving kindness properly, the whole purpose of loving kindness is you use an object just to generate the loving kindness. It's the most useful metaphor for loving kindness is a fire. And to start a fire, it doesn't really matter what fuel you use, it's the flames which are important. And usually if you're starting a fire, you want to use things which are easy to light. Fire lighters, pieces of paper, or whatever. So that's why, if you're doing loving kindness meditation, it's not a good idea to start with your enemy. It's like trying to start a fire with a big, heavy, wet lump of wood. You just waste so many matches. If you're starting loving kindness meditation, you have to start with something easy. That's why, in my experience teaching loving kindness, it's not a good idea to start with yourself. Because you are your enemy for most of the time. And it's just too hard to do. So with loving kindness meditation, it's wise to be able to choose an object which is very easy to develop loving kindness towards. A person who you like, and maybe even I use a little puppy or a kitten, even an imaginary one, or even a little plant or something which you've got on your shelf back home, whatever it is, something which you can generate feelings of warmth and affection even, easily. And then, just like lighting a fire, you don't stop with paper. Once the paper is alight, then you put on twigs, kindling. And from kindling you put on bigger pieces of wood. And then bigger pieces of wood. And when the fire is really going, then you can put on the big wet sappy log. Then you can give loving kindness to yourself or to your enemies. And when the fire is big, you'll be surprised yourself how you can have loving kindness towards yourself, how you can have loving kindness towards your enemies, which is so easy once the fire is strong. However, the point of loving kindness is not just to have love towards all beings, but to use this as a bona fide path into the liberations of the mind. From particular beings, you take away the fuel, and you're not concerned what's fueling the fire, you're concerned more with the heat from the fire, what loving kindness really is, without any object. So instead of saying love to all beings or love to particular beings, take off beings or all beings or one beings and just feel what loving kindness actually is. Before you radiate it to any one particular being or all beings. Make it boundless. Don't bind it to one or many beings. But once you get to the heart of loving kindness, what metta actually is, as an object of the mind, as part of the landscape of the mind, and you can focus on it, just like the beautiful breath, it's such a delightful thing to focus on, that it doesn't need any effort at all. Once loving kindness is there in the mind, you can maintain your attention on it just effortlessly, because the mind is having fun. For those of you who've had difficulty so far staying in the present moment or meditating or being with one thing, why is it that you can watch a movie on the television without moving for an hour or more? Even without any aches and pains in your body? Why is it that some of the Sri Lankans here can watch a cricket match all afternoon? Well, you can't watch your breath. You know why? Because you enjoy what you're doing. The more enjoyable the program is on the TV, the easier it is to watch. And you can forget hunger, you can forget aches and pains, you can even forget going to the toilet. But when you're meditating, you can't do that. because there's not enough joy in the meditation object. Joy, happiness, is the factor which leads to samadhi. That's straight out of the suttas. Again and again and again, the Buddha said, Sukhino chittang samadhiyati. From happiness, the mind attains samadhi. And that's why that if you're trying to force the mind onto it, the object, there's no happiness there, there's no delight, there's no joy. There can never be any samadhi. So loving kindness is a beautiful meditation because it's naturally full of so much happiness. It's better than watching sort of a great movie. Delightful just to watch for hours on end. And because you're watching it effortlessly, it leads to the jhanas. And then it really does become a liberation of the mind. It's an object of the mind that leads into the mind. And when one is focusing on the mind and the body has disappeared, everything else has disappeared, that's when you are in jhanas. So this is how you do the loving kindness meditation to lead to these beautiful, blissful states of mind. It also has a side effect that when you have loving kindness as a practice, you do have a sense of forgiveness to all beings, a sense of compassion, and a natural inability to see the faults in others and only to accept them as beautiful human beings who have their place in this world. That you just can't have an enemy. So that's what we do with loving kindness. Loving kindness is conditioned, but it can lead to the jhanas. The jhanas are still conditioned, but from the jhanas you can get a glimpse of unconditioned. So it's a path into unconditioned states. Does that make sense? If anyone has any questions on what I say, just to continue the discussion because it's something interesting, just put your hand up and ask a question. In walking meditation, are you mindful of the breath or the step you take? In walking meditation, there's many ways to do walking meditation, but in order to keep it in line with the other meditation you're doing here, when you start doing the walking meditation, the first stage should be present moment awareness. So when you're walking, you're not really concerned about the dinner which is coming later, you're not worried about what happened before, you're not even worried about the next step you're taking. You're worried, or rather concerned, only about whatever's happening now. That could be the step you're taking now, it could be the sound of the birds around you, it could be the warmth of the sun on you. As long as it is in this moment. So as you walk, make that the first stage, being present, so your mind isn't wandering off to the past or the future. Second, when you're walking and you've got present moment awareness, or you take that present moment awareness from the sitting, cushion or the chair, out walking, silence. So stop the inner commentary when you're walking. See if you can just walk silently inside. Not talking to yourself, not asking yourself questions, not giving yourself orders. Make that the goal of the meditation, of walking meditation, to get some silence. Once there's present moment awareness and silence, the next stage of walking meditation is going from diversity to unity. That's where you start to put your attention onto the feet. So you know the mood, the feelings in the feet, which part of the foot is moving, where it is, focusing on one thing. It's not a good idea to focus on the breath when you're walking, because it means that the mind is split between the feet and the breath. Part of your mind will have to be on the feet, because you have to know where you're walking. If you're completely on the breath, so you probably walk over the cliff down here and fall down the hill. It's true, actually. There's, I've already heard about this one monk who had such strong meditation he could get into jhanas with doing walking meditation. But it was not a good idea because as soon as he got into these deep states, he just completely left all awareness of his body, just kept on bumping into things. It's not a good idea. So in walking meditation, keep the meditation in line with what you do when you're sitting. The natural letting go, quietening of the mind. The present moment awareness to silence to one-pointedness. And there's not much further you can go in walking meditation. That's why that if you get very peaceful when you're walking, even stand still. Maybe the meditation can go a bit deeper there. Any questions on that? Yes? When thoughts arise when you're walking, look upon them like flies coming on your mind. Brush them away. So don't entertain them. See this as an irritation. Don't sort of get interested in the thoughts. This is a nice thought. And start having thoughts about thoughts and thoughts about thoughts about the thoughts. And getting into thinking. They have a simile in the English language called a train of thought. Trains are very easy to stop when they're just moving out of the station, because they're not going very fast. When the first thought comes, it's easy to stop. But once the train has moved out of the station and it's running along the tracks, it's going so fast and it's so heavy, it takes a long time to stop. So if you let thinking get a foothold in your mind, and the thoughts are running very fast and strong, it's very difficult to stop. The time to stop thought is when they first arise in the mind. Say, not now. Does that make sense? Yeah?
What happens if you're walking a lot and then you sit down, but your feet still feel like they want to walk further?
Well, then just don't sort of stop walking so soon. Because here the schedule about, it says outside on the list, 9 o'clock this, 10 o'clock that, that's only a guideline. If you're walking meditation and you're enjoying it, continue. And don't sit. And when it comes down to sitting, then just fold the legs underneath if you're sitting on a cushion on the floor. Get them comfortable and then take away all the awareness from the body. Because the body is... It bluffs you so often. Sometimes even an ache. It's like you're sitting down. I already mentioned the simile of putting a child to sleep. Sometimes if you're sitting down here, you get yourself nice and comfortable and your knee starts to ache. It's like the knee telephones you. Sort of, and if you pick up the telephone and start a conversation, all the rest of the body will realize you're in and they'll start calling you. It'll be the sort of the ear is itchy or the nose is itchy. Also, if you want to scratch just on the back there somewhere. It's because once you start answering the phone, they know you're in. If once the knee starts to ache, if you don't pick up the receiver, it'll keep on ringing for a while. And then once they realize there's no one at home, the telephone will go silent. And the knee doesn't hurt anymore. And there's no other scratches or itches or heat or cold. It's a terrible thing about the body. It always demands for comfort, but it never gives you comfort. Every time you move, why do you move? To try and find some comfort in the body, to try and escape from the discomfort of the body. Every time you wink, or you do your nose, or you scratch your ear, or you move your head, or you blink, or whatever else I see people doing here, that's always to try and get some comfort. If you see just how much time this body occupies, how demanding it is, it's worse than having a baby child. Those of you who've got a little child who know just how much attention it takes, your body takes as much attention, if not more. Never leaves you alone, even when you go to sleep at night. Always telling you to move me over, you know, give me a glass of water, take me to the toilet. Never comfortable. The only time it is comfortable when you stop answering the phones. Then it is comfortable. You can just sit here and just don't feel a thing. And be careful with the body. It's a liar. Yes? Yeah, a blank mind, but it should be not a dull mind. A blank mind is, in a sense, just a mind which hasn't got any thoughts in it. But a mind which is like very mindful, very aware that it's got no thoughts in it. So instead of, it's like simile of a television set again. Television set, say if you're watching, say, a tennis match. There are two tennis matches being played on there. It's what you're seeing on the screen and what you're hearing through the speakers, the commentary. And what you're hearing through the speakers is always biased. If it's, say, when New Zealand are playing an Australian, and it's the ABC who's commentating, then the Australian man is really unlucky, and the New Zealand guy is cheating or something. It's always wrong, you know, it's biased. If it's the other way around, it's the Australian who's cheating. The commentary is nowhere near as close to truth as what you see on the screen. So using that simile, if you really want to know what's happening on that tennis match, turn down the volume. And so you're seeing for yourself what's happening. You have all the information there you need. In the same way when you're meditating, turn down the commentary. So you're experiencing the world rather than thinking about it. And you're getting much closer to the truth. The menu is not the same as the food. It just gives you a description of what the taste is going to be like. But really tasting it is the only way to know what the food is really like. The menu is the descriptions, the thoughts. This is what one realizes, that after a while, all these words, all these thoughts, all these descriptions, they're signposts pointing to something. The old simile in Zen Buddhism is a finger pointed to the moon. Don't just stay with the finger. Look to where it's pointing to. And see the moon. We talk about loving kindness. Forget about the word. What's that pointing to? Silence. Listen to silence. Don't think about it. This is how you get the wisdom and also the happiness of meditation. Getting beyond this thinking mind. Is that okay for now? Okay, you can ask another question later on, because I've got quite a few to go through. Present moment awareness. Is it awareness of the quietness of the mind in the moment? Again, I've mentioned this already, present moment awareness means awareness of anything which is happening now. It can be a feeling in the body, a pain, it can be the sound of my voice, it can even be a thought through your mind, as long as you are noticing it now. A very good simile for present moment awareness is listening to a fine piece of music. Because if you're listening to a fine piece of music, you cannot linger on the last note or the last chord. If you do, you miss the note which is happening now. That's why when people listen to fine music, they do get a sense of quietness and serenity, because it forces them to be in the present moment. And mostly it forces them to be silent as well. Because I'm not sure if you've ever been to concerts. I remember when I went to concerts before I was a monk, you never turn around to your partner and start talking. So that was really nice, wasn't it? They say, shut up, you're listening. You haven't got a chance to make any comment whatsoever, because you know, the music is completely filling every moment. In the same way that when you delight in this meditation, it's like beautiful music. The beauty of the present moment is filling every moment. You haven't got a chance to say anything. Silence and present moment awareness coalesce. The awareness of the silence, either the ringing sound of the ear, is a silent environment awareness of the feeling of peacefulness, or release, like the feeling of release after a long call at the toilet, or all of the above, none of the above. The awareness of the silence, yeah, don't have like a ringing sound in the ear. It's not physical silence I'm talking about here, it's the silence in the mind, the lack of commentary, the lack of thoughts. So what you're experiencing, you're not giving an opinion about. You're experiencing it with the confidence just to know it without explaining it to somebody. It's strange that whenever we have any experience, we always like to take notes so we can explain it to somebody else, or at least to ourselves. Here we just realize you cannot capture these experiences in words. So just leave them as they are. Know them and move on without even giving it a label or a name. So present moment awareness is just that, the awareness of what's happening now. Knowing this present moment, because the past and the future are all gone. And you're just now. Now, now, now. Please explain about walking meditation. I think I've already mentioned that. With the three stages, present moment awareness, silence, and then being with your feet. Okay, please could you explain how you apply the present moment awareness to walking meditation? Say, great minds think alike. Okay, another walking meditation question. When walking with I'm sure to die, left foot automatically, the next thing that occurs to my mind is, so make the most of it, with the right foot. That's very good. With those mantras, if you're walking, it's I will die, left foot, that's for sure, right foot. I will die, that's for sure. This is using a very nice mantra. And actually see what happens when you do that. I will die, that's for sure. Not just one or two or three steps. Do that like 100 times. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Because we're very stubborn. And when you say these things, people laugh because that's just a defense mechanism. In denial. You know the first person who was found with that situation? The first person with psychiatric problems was Moses. He was found in denial. What a terrible joke, isn't it? So anyway, I will die, that's for sure. And after a while, it actually gets through to you. It gets like past your defenses. And the wonderful thing is that at first, you know, fear comes up. You know, fear of losing all your attachments, your worldly attachments. And then you realize, I will die, that's for sure. And then you get a great sense of peace. Because all those worldly attachments are not important anymore. There's a sense of letting go. So doing the I will die, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure, again and again and again and again and again, gives you a great deal of sense of peacefulness. It's another example of why I keep on saying, when there's insight, there will be peace. When there's peace, there will be insight. You cannot split the two up. If it really is insight, you understand the meaning of that, I will die, that's for sure. You get so quiet and so still and so peaceful. And when you're very, very peaceful, you can see all these things. It's insight. You cannot split the two up. Ajahn Chah kept on saying that, the Buddha kept on saying that, and you'll experience that yourself. Is there anything else on that one? When the mind momentarily stops feeling the breath, it dwells on perceiving the changes in colours from red, orange, yellow to light space in the meditative... into light space. Is the meditative process on the right track? If no, where does it lead to? If not, how to correct the process? Okay, it's a good question. This is, hopefully, sounds like that when the mind stops feeling the breath, momentarily, that's a problem. Usually, that the way I explain this, and I'll explain it tomorrow, is this stage of the meditation, when lights come up in the mind, these are called nimittas. This is when the mind starts to become more powerful than the five external senses. You should all know that in Buddhism we have six senses, and the sixth sense is nothing like that movie a few years ago, which was all Hollywood. the sixth sense is the mind, which is independent of the other five senses. And this is one of the insights you can experience in meditation, which gives you a full knowledge of what happens to you after death. Takes away any doubts about rebirth when you get to know what that mind is and how it is completely independent, if it wants to be, of the body and the five senses. But for most people, the five senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste and touch is so strong it swamps the mind. What we think is the mind is just the thoughts about the sight, sound, smells, taste and touches. It's not the real mind, not the pure mind. And that pure mind is what you get to when you get into the deep stages of meditation. But in this particular situation here, I just use my hands here, the five senses are so loud, they drown out the mind. But in this type of meditation, you're quietening down the five senses. You're closing your eyes, you're not listening to things. You're taking the awareness from many feelings in the body to one feeling, just the breath. And you're calming that down. What you're actually doing is sensory deprivation of the five senses, but in a way which is far more effective than going into one of these flotation chambers. As the five senses start to slow down and start to get very, very soft, and the amplitude starts to disappear, it gets to the level of the mind. And the sixth sense can sometimes just become louder, as it were, and can manifest. And that's how it manifests as a light sometimes. But because the five senses aren't really suppressed, they've just gone down a little bit, the light only sort of manifests momentarily and doesn't last at all. The five senses still need some more attention just to calm them down even more. So usually if lights appear in the mind, but momentarily, just don't concern yourself about them at all. Just stay with the breath and keep your attention on that. Remember this first simile I gave last night about the leaf? Make sure you're not moving the leaf. Then the leaf will get slower and slower and slower. The five senses will get less and less and less. And the mind will keep popping up longer and longer and longer until the five senses become swamped by the mind. And the mind manifests in the jhana. And the five senses are basically turned off. And people can shout and you don't hear. They can poke you and you don't feel. That's a sign of a jhana. The mind is manifested and you're with the mind rather than the five senses. And when you emerge from that afterwards, there's many great insights which you can get from that data. So for that question there, when lights actually manifest very quickly and they're moving all over the place, know that the mind is becoming strong, but it's not strong enough yet. Go back to the breath, maintain your attention on the breath and calm the breath down and forget about those lights for the time being. But I will actually mention that again tomorrow. When you practice awareness of the initial stages, have you to have an anchor for the mind? You don't need an anchor for the mind in the initial stages, because your anchor is those stages. Your anchor is the present moment. Your anchor is silence. So there may be other things. You may be aware of the breath, but the point is that you're not doing this particular stage to be aware of the breath. The main purpose is to be present. You can use the breath for that purpose. You can use the breath for silence. Just to know the breath without saying anything about it. But really the anchors here are just those particular stages of meditation. I give a simile for mindfulness of the gatekeeper. And it's actually a simile from the Buddha. Instead of like a gatekeeper, maybe you can say it's like a guard of your house. Imagine, this is what mindfulness is, and people don't understand mindfulness very well. Imagine that you have got a very wealthy mansion, and you come to a meditation retreat, and you're wealthy enough to leave a guard on the gate. You know, like some of these mansions or some of these condos, or you have guards on the gate, and you tell the guard to be mindful of thieves, because you've got many expensive belongings in your house and you're going off to a meditation retreat for 8 or 9 days. Be mindful of guards. Be mindful of thieves. And the guard said, yes, I'll be very mindful of thieves. And when you go home, you find that your house has been burgled. And you ask the guard, said, I told you to be mindful of thieves. And the guard said, I was mindful. I saw the thief going in. I saw them going out again. I noted carrying your digital TV, carrying your digital TV. I was very mindful. I was aware all the time. Would you be very happy with such a guard? Keeper is to be aware, but also to take action. Now, if they see thieves coming into your house. If they see thieves trying to come in, keep them out. If they see thieves already in the house, get rid of them, call the police. If they see my friends and relations want to come in, invite them in. And if you see the friends and relations already there, make sure they can have free access to the fridge and whatever else is there. Because one of the best ways of keeping thieves out is have your friends at home. Hopefully many of you have worked out that I've just been talking about the four right efforts, which are part of mindfulness. The four right efforts to keep unwholesome states out. Keep the thieves out if they haven't already come in. Second right effort, if there's unwholesome states already in the mind, do something to get rid of them. If thieves are in your house, call the police. The next thing is make sure that you invite wholesome states into the house, into your mind. If you see some friends and relations, you know, come invite them in. And fourth of the right efforts, if there's wholesome states of the mind already there, make sure they last a long time. If you have friends in your house, make sure that they feel comfortable so they stay a long time. That's the job of mindfulness. It's not just to be aware. It's also instructions as well. And in the gatekeeper simile, which the Buddha used, he said that you have to tell the gatekeeper with clear instructions what you want to have allowed into your mind, what you want to keep out. So in the first stage of the meditation, you tell the mindfulness, the gatekeeper, be alert, only let in present moment things. If you see the past or the future trying to sneak into the city, keep them out. If they manage to get in, call the guards and throw them out. That's what you tell the gatekeeper of mindfulness in the first stage of the meditation. If you give very clear instructions, you find that mindfulness will do its job. The gatekeeper will keep out the past and the future. Later on, you tell the gatekeeper, keep out thinking. Only allow in silence. Mindfulness knows what the task is. So if a thought arises in the mind, straight away, no, not the right time. You don't entertain thoughts. You entertain silence. When it gets to the breath, you tell the gatekeeper, now the only thing which I'm allowing into the city, my mind, is the breath. Any other things, like a feeling in my knees? No, I'm not going to answer the phone. It's, you know, someone making the sound next to me, that's their problem. I'm going to watch the breath. You only allow the breath in. If you teach mindfulness this way, you find that mindfulness is very effective and it does its job. Give clear instructions, like to the taxi driver, once or twice is enough, and mindfulness, the gatekeeper, will do the right thing. Most gatekeepers get confused because you give too many instructions too frequently, you don't give the gatekeeper a chance. So mindfulness awareness is teaching the gatekeeper, and then you find the mind will have in it the things which you want to have in it. Any questions on that? Next one. I want to know in more detail the three steps for successful meditation. Is it silence, breathing, and three? First thing is present moment awareness, then silence, and then just silent present moment awareness of the breath, then full awareness of the breath, so saying, then awareness of the beautiful breath, as you calm the breath down, and then when the breath disappears, the nimittas and after the nimittas, the jhanas. All these things are just stages of letting go. Each stage lies within, or the next stage lies within the stage you're in now. So if you can imagine like going on a journey, you don't have to walk forward, you don't have to walk back, you just have to stand still where you are. And the next stage comes from within the stage you're in now. So you don't need to go on to the next stage, you go in to the next stage. That's a very simple thing to state, but it's very profound. You never go on to the next stage in this meditation. You go in to the next stage. And present moment awareness, if you really go deeply into the present moment, you purify present moment awareness, you come across silence. You're so much in the present moment, you haven't got a chance to think, to say something. All thinking is about the past. What's just happened? A commentary like on the television on the shot which the tennis player has just made. That was in, that was out. It always was in the looking back at the past. Full present moment awareness has to be silent. In the same way that listening to the great third piece of music, you can only listen to it in silence because it's fully present. And from silence, in the middle of the silence, you'll find your breath. You don't give up the silence, but you look into the silence, you purify the silence, you go into one object within that silence, the breath. From the breath, right within the breath, you get the full breath. Right within the full breath, you get the beautiful breath. Right in the middle of the beautiful breath, you get the nimittas. And right in the center of that nimitta, that beautiful light, you'll find the way into jhanas. It's always going in. Or the other simile of like the lotus. To get to the heart of the lotus, you don't need to throw away the lotus you have now. You just need to keep your attention on that lotus. And then the outer petals open up. And you've got the next stage, the innermost petal. Or the next inner petal. You don't have to throw that petal away. You just keep your attention, your mindfulness there on that stage. And it will open out and reveal within that series of petals is the next innermost petal. And you keep on going. And the meditation just opens out to you. You don't move. You don't go on to the next stage. You stay with the stage you're at now until it transforms into the next one. You go into the next stage, not onto the next stage. A deepening of contentment. A deepening of stillness. I hope you understand that point, because that's crucial to success in meditation. Okay, any question on that one? Okay, listening to one of your talks, you mentioned you gave away your motorbike. How do we give away our motorbikes? By being attached to items people have given us, does that mean we are being held in the past? If so, how can we let go? Just the story there was that when I was a school teacher, I had a motorbike and long hair. Can you imagine that? Motorbike and long hair. Boom! And I realized that when you become a monk, you don't need a motorbike. You don't need money either. So I had this problem. I had a motorbike, I had to get rid of it. So I couldn't take it to Thailand with me. So I asked a few of my friends, and eventually it was one of my mother's friends. Was interested in buying it. So I remember the occasion very well, that he came to my mother's flat and I took him downstairs to see the motorbike, showed it to him, and then asked him if he's interested in it, and he said he was. It was just the sort of thing he wanted. So, you know, how much did I want to sell it for? I said, well, go upstairs to settle up. So he went upstairs to my mother's flat, and he said, I asked him once again, do you really want it? And he said, yeah, how much? And I said, if you want, you can have it for free. And he looked, I always remembered, he turned around and looked at my mum. And my mother could read his gaze straight away. And he said, look, he's all right. No, he's not crazy. He's just offered to become a monk. He doesn't need any money. And that's one of the most delightful experiences there, because I found out from my mother afterwards, she was so surprised and shocked. It was the first time anyone had ever given him anything for free. And it was an expensive motorbike. And unfortunately, he died about a year later, but I was so proud that I taught him generosity. And how wonderful it is just to give something for free. I got so much happiness out of that. And being attached to items and to people is so much happiness to give, to share, to let go. So the less you have, the less you need to worry about. The less you have in your house, the easier it is to clean. How much time do you spend with housework? How much time do you spend going to shops, trying to find something to, furniture to put in your rooms? Wouldn't it be wonderful just to have a couple of rooms instead of 100 rooms or 10 rooms, 20 rooms? Isn't it a shame that in our society, the houses we have these days have to have family rooms, games rooms, television rooms, so many different rooms. We can only be in one room at a time. And unfortunately, we've got so many rooms that the husband's in one room, the wife's in one room, the child's in one room, and the other child's in one room, all in different rooms. There's no family anymore. So not only is it socially very beneficial just to have a small house, it's also much cheaper. You don't have to have such a big mortgage. You don't have to work so long on that. You can retire early. This is one of the biggest expenses of our life, isn't it? A house. What do we want such a big one for? So simplicity has got so much going for it. And so you give things away. And that's actually why we have monasteries, and monks' monasteries and nuns' monasteries, places you can give things to. And are we held in the past? How can we let these things go? Letting go is a marvellous thing, because every time you let something go, you feel so much happiness and so much freedom. Every time I've given up something, I felt so much freedom. And when I was at college, I gave up drinking alcohol as a student. And that was really radical, because as soon as I gave up drinking alcohol, I thought that was it, no more parties. But actually the opposite happened. I got invited to more parties because they wanted someone sober to drive them home. But I felt so free having made a decision like that when I became a vegetarian as a student. I felt so free. I'd actually made a decision and done something. I wasn't just following what other people were doing. And that saved me a lot of money. As a student in those days, I didn't have much money anyway. I couldn't see why you'd waste it on alcohol. I've got this theory. You know that in many parts of Australia, there's a water shortage. Maybe not in New South Wales now, but there's never really enough water. We should actually ban alcohol. Because, I mean, that wastes so much water. And as soon as a person drinks it, they have to wee it out in the toilet. It doesn't sort of stay with you. It wastes so much water, alcohol. That's going to be very popular, say things like that. So, letting go and giving up things, and giving up personal possessions as well. I mentioned yesterday that when I go travelling, Mac and Belle, Becky's here, you saw me at the airport, so just carrying my bowl and just a bag. I haven't got the bag, it's in the room there. That's all I travel with. Even going to Singapore was exactly the same, no more, no less. So wonderful just having a few things instead of having big bags and having to wait at the carousel for your bags to come round. You can travel so lightly when you're a monk. It's one of the great benefits of the holy life, is being free from the burden of possessions. There's this story. The man had four wives. An old story. You can't get away with that these days. You'd be crazy to try. Man had four wives. His newest wife, the fourth wife, he liked to dress up in fine clothes and get nice dresses and ornaments and makeup. And he always used to like to, give her nice things to wear. but she was very disobedient. Now, he loved her very much, but actually she didn't care much for him, she just went her own way. That was his newest wife. His third wife, the one he had just before, he was very proud of. He loved her very much as well. He used to show off to his friends and relations. And she was very impressive. And she sort of loved him, but not as much as he loved her. And his second wife, the second woman he married, was his confidant. He really loved her as well, but she loved him pretty much as well. But whenever he was in trouble, he'd always go to her for advice and for help sometimes in times of trouble. Even when he was short of money, she would help him. And his first wife, he didn't really love her much at all. In fact, he really neglected her. But really, she was the one who loved him the most and cared for him the most. And really, he was only where he was today because of her, because of his first wife. Now, after many years of living with these four wives, he got very old and sick, and he came to his last illness, and he knew he was going to die soon. And he realized he'd been very happy with his four wives, and so he thought how lonely he would be, sort of in heaven or wherever he was going to go. So he asked his fourth wife, the one he loved the most, the one he liked to dress up in fine clothes, and said, "Darling," he said, "I'm going to die soon. Will you go with me?" And she said, "No way." And even though it was quite obvious, it was actually really hurt him. He was so shocked that he loved this white woman so much, but she would not go with him to die. But nevertheless, he had three other wives, so he called in his third wife, the one he'd like to show off to his friends, and said, "Darling, will you go with me?" And she said, "Look, I'm sorry. I can't. It's impossible." And that also really disturbed him. He was so devoted to her. He thought that surely she must be devoted to him as well, but she wasn't. So he called him his second wife. "Darling, I'm going to die soon. Will you go with me?" And she said, "Look, I can go as far as the graveside, but I can't go any further." And so in desperation he called him his first wife, the wife who really loved him and cared for him for as long as he could remember. But he didn't really love her. In fact, he neglected her. She was very thin. He said, "Darling, will you go with me?" He said, "Of course, I'm always with you." And of those four wives, the fourth wife, the most recent, the one which she liked to dress up in fine clothes and ornaments and makeup, was his body. "Will you go with me?" "No way will your body go with you." His third wife, who he liked to show off to his friends, was his wealth. His nice house, his bank account, his big car. "Will you go with me?" "Sorry, I can't." The second wife, the confidant who would help him, was his family. "I'm sorry, I can only go to your graveside," said the family, "no further." And his first wife, the one he didn't really love all that much, he'd neglected, but who really looked after him, was his karma. "Will you go with me, darling?" "Yes, of course, I'm always with you." So if you're four wives, remember which one is the most important. Look after your karma wife, or your karma husband. Because everything else will leave you at death. That's a nice little story there. So, giving things up, letting things go, is letting go of your first, letting go of your second, third and fourth wife. And looking after your first wife, your karma. This is I mentioned this to someone at the BSV on Wednesday night. Because whenever you give an act of generosity, you'll never regret it. The times when I was a layman, when I gave charity to monasteries and monks and things, it's the best money I ever spent. I never regret that. The times I sort of took a girl out or sort of went to the pub, I regret that. That was a waste of money. But charity is never a waste of money. And every time you remember it, it gives you lots of happiness. So if you really want a good investment with maximum returns, charity. And that stock market never goes bust. So that's actually how you can learn how to let go, because it gets fun letting go. You see the results of it. And it means you see how stupid attachment to worldly things are. When I sit cross-legged, my legs go numb. Does this cutting off the circulation do nerve damage and cause permanent damage? Do we have compensation and legal insurance? We've got a few doctors here, so you should be okay. No, it doesn't, no. But actually, it's a good question, because I was afraid of that myself when I was a young meditator. My legs would sort of go numb as well. And this is because I wasn't in control of my thoughts. I started thinking. I didn't have too much idea of what was going on, but I thought that the legs go numb because there's no blood circulating. And I thought, if blood doesn't circulate very long, gangrene sets in. So I was so afraid. Whenever my legs would go numb, I'd always change my posture. And that was always so disturbing. I remember once sitting cross-legged and just getting frustrated that I was going numb again. So I thought, I don't care. And even if my legs do sort of have gangrene and I have to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, so what? And I just called the bluff of the body. You know what happened? I didn't even move a muscle, and after 5 minutes, without even moving, the blood started circulating again, all by itself. I called the body's bluff. That's all it was, just fear. And people told me afterwards, I mean, there's plenty of doctors in here, say, even when you go numb, there's still enough blood circulating through there to keep everything going okay. So you don't need to be afraid at all. Just sit there and forget about it, and the blood will come back all by itself. Next question. Your talk this morning answered my first question. There must have been another question there. The second truth gives craving as a cause of suffering and samsara. Dependent origination in a vertical sense shows ignorance as origin. Are these two one and the same? Very good question. The reason why it's ignorance as the origin. I don't like the word ignorance because that's just too academic. It means like if you know something, then that's the end of ignorance. I prefer the word delusion. The delusion. The Buddha once said that what the world says is happiness, the enlightened ones say is suffering. What the world says is suffering, the enlightened ones say is happiness. So as a monk living in a monastery, just eating in the morning time, just no television, no music, no this, no that, no sex. People think, wow, how can you do that? That's suffering. It's worse in jail. No, it's better in jail, sorry. It's worse in the monastery than jail. But they say that's suffering. I say that's happiness. You go back to work when you finish this retreat and say, where do you go for 10 days? Just sitting with aching knees and poor back, eating just only in the morning time. So getting up at 4:30 in the morning, you go back and you tell your friends you actually paid to do that. And they'll think you're crazy. What did you do that for? They'll think that's suffering. But if you know what you're doing this for, you say this is happiness. What the world says is happiness, I say is suffering. What does the world say is happiness? Falling in love and getting married. I say that's suffering. Or becoming rich. Now, winning the lotto, or sort of your shares, sort of going in this high-tech company and becoming an overnight millionaire. Would you like that to happen? Yeah, stupid. That's suffering. This is another beautiful little story. The more money you have, the more worries you have. Just be simple. The story of the children's wishing game. I think I told this the last time I was here in Melbourne during August or something. These little children were playing a wishing game. If you had one wish, what would you want? And the first child, only 5 years old, said, if I had one wish, I'd like to have an ice cream. It was a hot day. And they asked the next child, who was 6 years of age, if you had one wish, what would you wish for? He said, I'd wish for an ice cream factory. And the 5-year-old felt so stupid. Oh, if only I'd have thought of that because one ice cream goes so quickly. If I had an ice cream factory, I could have an ice cream whenever I wanted. Oh, how stupid I am, and how clever is that six-year-old child? And they get the seven-year-old child, what would your one wish would be? And his one wish would be, I wish to have $1 million. Then I could buy an ice cream factory and a sweet factory and many other things as well. And the boy who wanted an ice cream factory thought how stupid he was. And how clever was a seven-year-old, because you could have even more than I've got. And they turned to the eight-year-old boy. If you had one wish, what would you wish for? And he said, if I had one wish, I'd wish for 3 wishes. Then I could have an ice cream factory and then $1 million. And that's my third wish. I could ask for another 3 wishes. And the other boy said, now that's really smart. How can you top that? How can you be better than that? And then the nine-year-old child did even better. He said, if you had one wish, what would it be? And the nine-year-old child said, if I had one wish, I'd wish that I had no more wishes. And that was the Buddha. And the other children were smart and said, now that's a wise person. When you have no more wishes, you're content, you're at peace. Isn't that what you would want? To eventually have a mind which needs no more wishes, no more craving. The delusion is, those first children, if I could have the ice cream factory, $1 million, 3 wishes or innumerable wishes, then I'll be happy. That's suffering. Whenever you wish for something and craving for something, it means that what you want you haven't got yet. You're separated from what you want. That's called suffering. Hunger, thirst. When you have no more wishes, then you're content. That's enlightenment. That's peace. So the last child was the Buddha. So what the world says is suffering, I say is happiness. What the world says is happiness, I say suffering. That's what delusion is. So instead of ignorance, call it delusion. Because of delusion, we crave. We crave for things we don't need. We crave for things which are just going to give us more trouble. And this is the problem. So it's craving has its root cause in the delusion. If we were really wise, we realize we didn't really need very much at all. We crave too much, and the craving causes us so much suffering. Even in meditation, the delusion is that thinking that enlightenment is somewhere outside of you, the next stage, rather than realize it's going in. You know the story of the Buddha before he became enlightened? He wanted to test out to see whether he had what it takes to become enlightened. So he took his bowl and put it in the river Nirantara. And he determined, if I've got what it takes to become enlightened, may this bowl float upstream. And it did. It's a very beautiful metaphor. Because craving goes downstream. To go against craving is going upstream. It goes to the source of things. It goes to the spring, the Dhamma from which all this comes from. That goes against the stream. Against the stream of craving. That's where you find fulfillment. Not following craving, but going in the opposite direction. Craving goes outwards into the world. Meditation goes inwards to the moment. Inwards to the silence. Inwards to the mind. Inwards to Nibbana. It goes in completely opposite direction. It's hard to do as well. The force of the mind is always going outwards, away from the present moment, out to the past, out to the future. As soon as you've got silence, it's just so easy to disturb. It goes out into sounds, out into words. From the breath, it usually goes, wants to go out into something else. Even when you get nimittas, beautiful signs of the mind, it's so hard to keep them because you go out to somewhere else. Never going inwards. That's why delusion leads to craving. Okay. Is that okay? Another example just comes to my mind. When I was a young man, it shows you how delusion leads to craving. I saw this advertisement on the television. I still remember the advertisement for St. Bruno tobacco. This is smoking a pipe. This was before you knew that tobacco was bad for your health. And in this advertisement, this ornery-looking man, so he wasn't particularly handsome or big or anything, he started smoking the St. Bruno tobacco, walking down the street. And according to the advertisement, it was so irresistible that all these amazingly beautiful ladies, you know, that someone, one was a secretary, she put down her typing and just was running, completely entranced by the smell of this tobacco and the man smoking it. And these other people walking to the shop. And after a little while in this advertisement, all these very beautiful ladies were just following this ordinary man because of tobacco. However, when I smoked tobacco, it didn't work for me. Just delusion. Got sucked in. For all of you, I don't know if any of you work hard and get your Porsche car. It's exactly the same as the Bruno tobacco. You see in the advertisement, as soon as you get a flash car or a flash suit, then sort of you'll be attractive to other people. It doesn't work that way. But people buy into that delusion, at least the craving. Anyway, at the BSV, you mentioned briefly that proof exists that a stream of consciousness goes on after death. Could you please talk a little on this? And have you any personal experience to speak of in this instance, such as remembering past existences? This is what you will experience in your meditation. This is one of the benefits of getting a jhana experience, or even close to jhanas. This is where the mind separates from the five senses, and the five senses are your body. The body are the five senses. It's not that the five senses are there to protect the body. The body is there as a vehicle so the five senses can play in the world. And if the five senses, for some reason or another, wear out, the body dies. There's no use for the body anymore. Sensory experience is what this body is for. When you transcend those five senses and go to the world of the mind, one of the things you will realize is just how independent this mind is from the body. And you'll be actually experiencing what will happen to you when you die. You know those people have out-of-the-body experiences? Starting out of the body, what's the next thing they do? Go to the light. That light which appears when people die is exactly the same as what I've just been talking about, the nimitta. This beautiful light which appears in the mind, which you go towards in meditation. You're actually experiencing exactly what it's like to die when you get into a jhana. And that's, you're actually dying to the world. That's why when you come out afterwards, you realize what this mental consciousness actually is. You've actually experienced it for once. Once you know what it is, the insight should come up, unless you're very stupid, that the mind can exist independent of the body. And you'll know what will happen to you when you die. You know the process. And you will never think, you'll never have the view anymore that at death everything stops. You know what happens. That's one of the great benefits of that. You actually know the process of rebirth. Secondly, because after such an experience, and not even like a jhana, just even before, in upachara, even when you get nimittas coming up, the mind gets very strong and powerful. And those of you during this meditation retreat, if you get nice experiences later on, if you want to play around with this, I encourage you. At the end of the meditation, just don't get up and walk away. When the mind is still strong and bright and you're blissed out, ask yourself, what is my earliest experience? Like the simile of the gatekeeper, don't keep repeating it. Say it once. And then be quiet and listen and see what happens. What usually happens if you've got a strong mind and you're silent is that memories will start to come up from the past, from the distant past. And the memories you'll experience at this time are very different than what you normally call memories. They are a reliving of those early experiences. As a monk, I'm not allowed to tell about any experiences of past lives. So what I usually do is tell an experience of this life, when I first started doing this. And what came to my mind when I did exactly this after deep meditation. I asked myself, what's my earliest memory? What came into my mind was the experience in my pram as a baby. And fascinating, what came into my mind was actually the smell of my pram, which I immediately recognized. That was my pram. And I was a middle-aged man at this time. And afterwards, I was surprised why it was the smell and not sort of the sight or the feel of it. And apparently that I asked some doctors afterwards, and it's true that for the baby, the sense of smell develops as one of the prominent, if not the most prominent, senses. And you recognize your mother by the smell more than anything else. The sight hasn't really developed all that well yet, and sound hasn't developed that well. But smell has. And that's, I remember now, that's how I recognized my world as a baby. Not through seeing things and recognizing my mother through what she looked like, but how she smelled and how my pram smelled. And that smell was in my nostrils as I was experiencing this. And with any of these experiences that you know without a shadow of doubt, it's not a fantasy, it's not a dream, it's a real experience that this was you. You're not dreaming of somebody else's pram, that was my pram. And when you do have a past life experience, if it really is a past life experience, you'll come away with that without any doubt whatsoever that that was you. If there's any doubt there, you know, was this really me? Was this just an imagination? It's not a real past life experience. 100% certainty is part of the hallmark of such an experience. And that's what comes from having a sharp mind, and a powerful mind. So play around with that. It's good fun. Find out who you were before. So, once you get these experiences, then even if you can't remember your past lives, as long as you can get into deep meditations, you know for absolute certainty, it's proof for you, what happens after death. The stream of consciousness continues. Have no doubt. And when people ask you, you say, I know, I've experienced. Any questions on that one? Yes? Yeah. The only objective for remembering your past life, its main benefit is to prove once and for all that rebirth is a fact. Believing it because someone else said so, or because you're a Buddhist and you're supposed to believe in it, is not good enough. So just one experience is enough to actually to show you that what the Buddha actually taught was true. That there is samsara. You do go from life to life, and it's not just always up, 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 up. Sometimes it's down. Round like a wheel, up and down. And to know these things for yourself gives you that certainty, which puts the practice of Buddhism in a very good perspective. So never will you actually doubt the Buddha's teachings and think that maybe I should become a Christian or a Muslim or something. Because you've experienced something. So you're not a Buddhist by belief, you're a Buddhist because of experience. You know these is true. And it's marvellous that the Buddha's teachings are like that. That there is a practice, there is a path, there is an experiment where you can prove for yourself without any doubt that rebirth is. That was powerful for the Lord Buddha, because that was the first insight which arose when he was under the Bodhi tree, remembering his past lives. It's a very powerful thing, and a very beautiful thing to be able to have. Obviously you can indulge in that and just give it too much meaning. It's not so important what those past lives were, it's just that you've had them. So you know you existed before. And then it really shows you what the first noble truth of suffering is all about. It's not just suffering in this life, it's the suffering of rebirth. Going from life to life to life. Sometimes you have good ones, sometimes you have bad ones. Sometimes fortunate, sometimes unfortunate. And you've got a whole range of those to go if you don't become enlightened. You know, once I saw a movie before I became a monk called Dracula. But this was the thinking man's Dracula. It wasn't just like a Hollywood production just to frighten people. This Dracula was showing what happens if you live for eternity. This Dracula had been going for 300 or 400 years. And he'd literally been there, done that. He was bored out of his skull. And the whole movie was just showing that even though he had power to live forever, it was torment for him. And in the end, he allowed himself to be drawn out into the sunlight of the early dawn to be killed. Because living forever and ever and ever was shown to be just so painful. People in this world, they want to have eternal life. They think that's happiness. If you really think about that, eternal life, that would be so much suffering. What more can you do to interest yourself? It's bad enough already watching the television and seeing all these reruns. Now that amplify that 100 times, you know what eternal life is all about. Okay, and you have children, but how many times do you want to have children? When you get fed up with that after a while? Okay, I mean going up the Amazon or bungee jumping, and after a while you've done everything. There's nothing else to do. How long would it take until you've done everything you wanted to do in this world? You only find out another things you want to do, and then what do you do next? Eternal life is suffering. It's a fascinating idea that. So when you actually see samsara, eternal rebirth, that's suffering. I'll let you think about that. I need to conquer anger and fault finding. You cannot conquer anger and fault finding. Trying to conquer anger and fault finding is anger about anger, finding fault with faults. It is not something outward and verbal, it is a continuous dialogue in my mind, on and on and on. How do I try in my practice? Many are the obstacles that come in my way. I can no longer see the goodness in anybody, while I quickly look for the faults I can find. Great question. Part of this meditation retreat, I mentioned it in passing, but I'll emphasize it even more during the next few days, is to developing the perception of the beautiful. And this is so important in meditation. You can only stay still where you are, whether it's the silence or the breath, if you perceive the beauty in the breath. And all it is a training in perception. That's all. You've got the choice there to see the faults in something or see the beauty in something. And if you're going to be a successful meditator, if you want to find out about your past life, if you want to be enlightened, the only way is to learn to perceive the beauty in these stages. Once you get into this, it becomes so much fun. Again, you start to see the beauty in the nature outside, you see the beauty in the carpet. And if you can see the beauty in this carpet, grey industrial carpet, which is in front of you, then you can see the beauty in a human being. See the beauty in yourself. And anger gives way to a sense of appreciation and acceptance and metta, loving kindness. So here in this retreat, you'll actually be taught how to overcome anger and fault finding. And you'll be practicing those things. And you'll be able to achieve, at least for this retreat, times when there's no anger or fault finding whatsoever. And you find it's still the same carpet, it's still the same body, it's still the same retreat center. It's so beautiful and so wonderful. And you realize it's not the retreat center which is the problem. It's your fault finding mind is the problem. It's not you who is the problem. It's your anger is the problem. You're quite okay. It's not your mind which is the problem. It's the fault finding within it. You're just seeing it in the wrong way. That's delusion. So this practice of meditation is going to take you away from all of that until you can't get angry at all. Ajahn Brahm, born as a Buddhist in Sri Lanka, I have no problem practicing dharma, even though I chatter a lot as Thai ladies who prepare dharma at birth. I find it difficult to practice meditation as a mother and a housewife. How can I improve my practice while doing other things as a mum. You find that no matter what responsibilities and roles you play in life, that a little bit of meditation is so good for you. Some years ago, this man came to one of the weekend retreats, and after the retreat was finished, he told me what had been happening to him. He'd been coming to the center for many years, but his wife wasn't a Buddhist. He was an Australian, so was his wife an Australian. He wanted to go to the meditation retreats, but his wife would never let him. When a meditation retreat was about to happen, he'd say, "You know, darling, can I go to the meditation retreat this weekend?" And his wife would say, "No! On this weekend, we've got to go and visit my mother-in-law, we've got to go and do the shopping, we've got to take the kids to sport, you've got to mow the lawn, you've got to fix up all these things. There's too many things to do. No, you can't go." "Okay, darling." But every time, I don't know if people really speak like this in married life, I don't really know. I'm imagining. But apparently every time there was a retreat, he'd ask the same question, "Can I go?" And every time she'd say, "There's too many things to do. Shopping, washing, cleaning up the house, it's just too much. You can't leave me to do this all by myself." But one day, apparently, he asked his retreat on, "Can I go?" And she was just so frustrated that it had his persistence. She said, "Okay, you go and leave me with all of this. You know, you've gone and fucking feel guilty. I'll look after the kids. I'll do all the garden. I'll do all the shopping." So he went.